There's no other day in the Bible that receives as much in-depth attention as the day that Jesus died. This 24-hour period of time was the fulfillment of God's eternal purpose in sending His Son to this earth. And on that day, Jesus died upon the cross for our sins and placed into motion the opportunity for this salvation to be made available and the redemption from our sins that we have acknowledged here in the observance of the Lord's Supper this morning. This day began really at sundown and continued to the following sundown from what we would say Thursday at sundown till Friday at sundown. That was the Jewish calendar, the Jewish way of reckoning time. And on that beginning of that 24-hour period, from Thursday to Friday, is the day that Jesus died that I am focusing on in this study. 3 days later, of course, Jesus rose from the dead early on the first day of the week. 2 weeks from today will be the day that the world considers to be the day that Jesus rose from the dead. And we're backing up and looking at this more in depth from the perspective of the day that Jesus actually died. Beginning at 7 p.m. approximately was when Jesus met with His disciples in the upper room in Jerusalem, and they observed the Passover, what would be perhaps the final Passover as God's reckoning of the Old Testament system. And during that, Jesus introduced the memorial that we just have celebrated here, the establishment of the Lord's Supper with His own disciples. That whole ceremony evening together must have lasted about 3 to 4 hours. And so it was somewhere around perhaps 11 p.m. that Jesus and His disciples left and went out to the Mount of Olives about a mile from Jerusalem. And there in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prayed very earnestly and went and found His disciples sleeping three times and went back into the garden and prayed further. And He prayed, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but Your will be done." And at the end of that time, He came out, and Judas and the guards of the temple were coming for the purpose to arrest Him, which they did. And so we're picking up in our continuous of this today at about 1 a.m. in the morning. And as Jesus submitted to this arrest, Peter drew a sword and cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. And Jesus turned to him and said, "Put up your sword into your sheath. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?" And he showed by this his submission to the Father and his resolution to carry through and knowing that He was about to give His life for us. But we're beginning this morning in the continuing of this account at about 1 a.m. And so at the time that most people of Jerusalem were asleep by this hour, after following their own Passover celebrations, and after His own disciples had all fled, who had shared His life with Him for the last 3 years after He had first called them near the Sea of Galilee, Jesus was led, bound hand and foot by these temple guards, back into the city of Jerusalem. And only two of His disciples, Peter and John, followed from a distance. So they passed back through the valley separating between the Garden of Gethsemane and the walls of the city of Jerusalem, And about a 20-minute walk, and it took them about a mile back into the city of Jerusalem, and they would have passed below the lofty pinnacle of the temple where Jesus had been tempted by the devil to cast himself down to prove, as the angels would swoop down and catch him, that he was indeed the Messiah. So they passed along by there, and then walked up through the lower city of David that had been built over 1,000 years earlier by King David himself, and climbed up a long stairway that would have led them back up into the upper city to the house of the high priest. And we read in verse 53 of Mark chapter 14 that they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests, the elders and the scribes. But Peter followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. So they would have arrived here at the home of the high priest at maybe around 1:30 a.m. in the morning. The scripture points out that Sanhedrin council now was hastily convened in the middle of the night. Contrary to all standard procedure by the Sanhedrin council, which under all normal circumstances met only in the daytime and never during a feast of the Jews. So here, during a feast of the Jews and in the middle of the night, the Sanhedrin council was called together quickly. And this type of arrangement shows the secrecy that they were trying to achieve and the unorthodox nature of these proceedings, that they were trying to bring Jesus into custody here without the other people of the city really knowing what was happening. Now, the Sanhedrin Council was a council that normally met in an area of the temple. If you look on this map, there's a small diagram in the right-hand corner that shows the way the temple was laid out. And there was a certain area there where the Sanhedrin Council normally met. It was called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. But on this evening, they were not meeting there. They were meeting in the home or the palace of the high priest, Caiaphas. The Sanhedrin Council was a council made up of 71. Here we see the steps that still today are in the city of Jerusalem that lead to the home of Caiaphas the high priest. That home and that place have been identified. And inside that home is a holding cell that archaeologists believe may have very well been where Jesus was kept in custody, awaiting the bringing him in before the Sanhedrin council. And later on, as they, in between that trial and taking him to Pontius Pilate. But it was a holding cell that is still there today, underground. So Jesus might have been kept in that. And it said in Matthew 26 and verse 57 that those who laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and elders were assembled. But the Sanhedrin council was the highest ruling Jewish council. It was made up of 71 men, of 24 priests and 46 elders. And that made 70, and then the high priest made 71. That concept, the very idea of it, was taken from the Old Testament in the book of Numbers in chapter 11 and verse 16, where the Lord said to Moses, "Gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them to the tabernacle of meeting, that they may stand there with you." So in the Old Testament, God provided an arrangement of 71 men to judge the nation of Israel, 70 of the elders and Moses. And to this day, or to the day of Jesus, the Jews were following that tradition, that practice. And so that is where the origination came from, the concept of the Sanhedrin Council, which the word Sanhedrin means the 70. And they were considered to be the wisest men and the most pious men of the nation. They were men who had devoted their lives to God. And so there was an irony, a very tragic irony that is seen in this whole scene, in that here was the Son of God who had come down from heaven to this earth to walk on this earth as so that he might become one of us. Almost as if an emperor would go out and live among his subjects and wear ordinary clothing just so that he could get to know the people. And no one would even know that he was the emperor. That is how Jesus had come down to this earth to live here and be one of us among those who were sinful. And yet, here on this occasion, it was not the sinners that had gone out and arrested Jesus. No, it was the most pious, godly men of the nation that had seen that their need to go and arrest him and bring together a meeting of the council in the middle of the night, secretly, and contrary to the practice of the Old Testament law and the established procedure of the Jewish nation, in order to carry out what they had decided was needing to be done. And that was to put Jesus to death. Now, in the Old Testament law itself called for justice among the people of Israel, that they were not to carry out injustice. There were procedures, there were things that were built into the law to ensure that they would be a people of justice. In Deuteronomy chapter 16, and verse 18 said, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all of your gates, which the Lord your God gives you according to your tribes. And they shall judge the people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality nor take a bribe. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you." And so therefore, the Jewish people by this time had added several aspects to their own laws. That, number one, they would not hold a trial during one of the holy feasts of the Jews. Another one, they would not do it in the daytime. They would not do it at night. They would do it in the daytime. Another one said that they would not pass sentence on a man, on anyone accused of a crime, without taking at least a 24-hour intermission before the final verdict was given. And all of these were ignored. All of these were violated on the night that Jesus was brought into their trial. And so the question that we can't help but ask is, how did this happen? Because here were these men who were the most pious religious men on the face of the earth, and they were so blinded by their love of power and their fear of losing it that they did not recognize the Son of God standing in their very midst. They put him on trial for blasphemy. And it was Jesus' own testimony that we will see that enraged them and convinced them that he was worthy of this death penalty. And so they found him guilty, convicting God of a crime worthy of death. And it's ironic, they found God guilty of blaspheming against himself. And not only that, they went up and spat on him, and they began to blindfolded him and beat him. And in Mark 14 and verse 65, it said, "Prophesy to us, you Messiah. Prophesy to us. Tell us who it was who struck you." And then they turned him back over the guards to beat him again. How could these righteous, godly men resort to such illegal practice and unjust behavior and cruel treatment of this man? even if they did believe that he wasn't Messiah, why would pious men who were pillars of the community walk up and spit in his face, blindfold him, mock him, and then smite him with their own hands? How could it happen? And the answer is because of their fear. Their fear of Jesus and what he represented. They were afraid of him. They were afraid that he was a threat to them and to their power. And that fear that they had bred hatred in their minds and in their hearts. And hatred all too often leads, as we know, to terrible acts of inhumanity and injustice. And so this story really isn't just about those 71 supposedly pious Jewish men back there in the first century. It's really about how we as human beings sometimes have that same kind of fear, even today. And it works inside of us like poison and causes us to react in much the same way that the Jewish leaders reacted toward Jesus. What am I referring to? In John 11, verse 49 and 50, one of them, Caiaphas, the high priest himself, being high priest, said to them, this was following the raising of Lazarus from the dead by Jesus, and how people were talking about that here Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, and the news of that was spreading around. And Caiaphas said, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish." And so, in effect, what Caiaphas was saying was, this man is dangerous. If people continue flocking after him, the Romans are going to get wind of this. And who knows what they will do to our people. This could lead to a great deal of pain for our nation and certainly for us. And it would be better for one man, don't you all agree, for one man to die than for all the people to suffer. So once he put it in those words and put it before the others, it was not hard to sell that idea to the rest of the council. And so it was because of fear that they had of the threat that they perceived Jesus was to their power and what it might lead to with the nation of the Romans coming against their nation. The point that I'm wanting us to consider is fear and what it does and how it can poison a person's mind and cause us to act totally out of character to how we would normally think and react in a particular to a person or a situation. Because of fear, it changes the whole way that we react. Like when we were calm and cool, we would never do that. We would never act that way. But because we are afraid and we feel threatened, we lash back out in a certain way. And part of that is that we all have a mechanism that I believe God has given to us that is like a self-preservation instinct. And in many cases, it is to our good to have this, because if we are in danger, we will exert all of our energy to get out of that situation to protect ourselves. Maybe to just run away and get out of there. But that's a self-preservation instinct that we all have. And it's good. But it can be used if we perceive a threat of a person to our security. And we feel insecure. It can cause us to retaliate against that person unfairly and wrongly. And I believe that is what was happening here among the Jews. But it can also happen among us. We can react the same way. And all too often, most of us can relate to that it's already happened at different times in our life. And so we distort and misuse this God-given self-preservation instinct, and you know it, and I know it, that it's true. That it's a weakness that we all have and share. We need to be aware of it. So when we look at the Sanhedrin Council that night and how they responded, how their whole setup, how they were acting in secret, meeting in the middle of the night, bringing up these trumped up false charges against Jesus, and then going up and spitting on Him and blindfolding Him and making fun of Him. How does that relate to you and me? Well, we're given a glimpse of fear and how it works on our personhood, or on our minds, and how it can cause us to react in that way. And so we can still be influenced that way, how we react to others, even though we would know in our better mind state that is wrong to act that way. And yet we will, because of it's a fear of a threat, that's what we will sometimes react and treat someone in that way. And justify it in our mind at the time that, well, that's what the situation calls for. I didn't have any choice. I had to react that way because I was in threatened, or I felt that I was being threatened. And so whether it happens on a personal level or sometimes in societies can do this, and we see it happening even today in the world as we look around. This very thing where people perceive it as a threat. And so they justify taking it all out on this person or this group of people. And it's just obviously totally wrong what they do. Whether we're talking about the Salem witch trials back in 1692, or some of the Jim Crow laws and the lynchings that happened in the South back in earlier days, or some of the racial and ethnic cleansing that's going on in the world today. It all goes back to the same thing of fear and what it does to people when they operate in a group mentality, and it can take over their minds and they begin to act in a very vicious, violent way. That we would think, why would godly, pious men have done this to Jesus? These are supposed to be the wisest men in the nation. They're supposed to be godly men. And here they are. Look at the way. But we need to ask the question, what would I have done? What would you have done if you were there that night? Would you have done any different? If I had been there that night, would I have been one of those who would reacted out of that type of fear and insecurity? And would I have condemned Jesus of guilty of blasphemy? Would I have said, yes, he's guilty? Would I have gone up there and spit in his face and mocked him and said, you've got a blindfold on, tell me who just hit you if you're the Son of God? Would I have acted that way? Would any of us here this morning have acted that way? Because we have that self-preservation instinct in us that sometimes it goes off the charts. And we react not just defending ourselves in a physical danger. There is no physical danger, perhaps. But it's a perceived danger. It made us feel insecure, and we were threatened by, for whatever the reason. And so we began to act in a way that we should never, it would be the unthinkable can happen in that type of situation. So it's a poison. It performs its work inside. It affects us to personally react in the wrong way and motivates groups of people to sometimes do the unthinkable thing. I have a feeling there were people there that night in the Sanhedrin who, if you went up and talked to them later on, and they would have been honest enough to say, why did I agree with that? Why did I do it? Why didn't I speak up? Why did I go along with it? And yet, there weren't any. who spoke up. They went on to condemn Jesus and take him to Pilate. And the next morning, many of them crying out, "Crucify him, crucify him." And there's only two of the Sanhedrin council that there's any evidence that they did not line up with the others. And that was Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. But even they did not speak up when they had the opportunity. And we've all been in that situation, that we get in a situation, we be part of a group, and the group starts talking about, here's what we want to do. And it's wrong, and you know it's wrong. But you're in the minority, and you're the only one. And if one person, just one person, would speak up, it could stop it from happening. But all too often, no one speaks up. And so the unthinkable happens. And people look back on it later and they say, why was I involved in that? Why didn't I say something? Because of fear. Because if you did speak up, then it would make you look foolish in front of that other group of people. And so you don't say anything. During World War II in Nazi Germany, there was a Lutheran minister named Martin Niemöller. He saw all the wrongs that were happening. He later wrote about this. And he at first decided not to say anything, but later he did begin to speak up. And he said, first they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. And then one day they came for me. And by that time, there wasn't anyone left to speak up. And I'm also reminded of the quotation of the 18th century British politician Edmund Burke, who said, "The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing." So no one spoke up in the Sanhedrin. And yes, there are those times in our lives today when you and I are part of a group that is talking about their plan to do something that we know to be wrong. And we see that injustice about to happen. And all it would take is for one person to speak up. But everyone remained silent. That's what happened here the night that we're studying. Meanwhile, Jesus did have the courage to testify and answer the question that was put to him. As these pious men looked for reasons to put him to death, Jesus could see their growing frustration. They brought in witnesses, but none of the witnesses could agree. And one of the principles of the Old Testament law was you cannot condemn a person unless there are at least two witnesses who agree to the charge. And they could not find two witnesses. And so finally, in verse 61, the high priest stood up in the midst and, "Do you answer nothing?" he said. "What is it these men testify against you?" But he kept silent. And again, the high priest asked him, saying, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus gave the testimony, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Jesus answered the question. He spoke up. He did not remain silent. And in doing so, in this one sentence, Jesus cited three well-known Old Testament texts. He said, "I am." And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Now, when the question was asked, Jesus could have said, yes, I am the Messiah. In other words, I am the Son of the Blessed. But he didn't say that. He said, I am. And that immediately called attention back to the account in Exodus chapter 3, 1500 years earlier, when Moses was at the burning bush. And he asked God, he said, well, what will I tell them? What is your name? And God said, I am who I am. Tell them, I am has sent me to you. The eternal God. That's what Jesus said, I am. And then he didn't stop there. He said, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power. That called attention to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 and 14. Behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. And then all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. But he also said, you will see the Son of Man coming with clouds of heaven, sitting at the right hand of power. This called attention to Psalm 110, verse 1 and verse 4. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Jesus covered a lot in that one sentence. And the high priest and the others were familiar with these scriptures from the Old Testament. And so the high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. And so it was Jesus' own testimony that not only was he the Messiah, but he is the I Am. And God has promised that he will be sitting at his right hand in the heavens, and that he will return again on the clouds of heaven, and that all people, not just the Jews, but all people and all dominion will be given to him. And when they heard that claim being made, their reaction was, how can he have the audacity to be blaspheming God in this way? Well, meanwhile, outside in the courtyard, another drama was taking place because Peter had come into the courtyard and one of the servant girls of the priest eventually came. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you also were with Jesus the Nazarene. But he denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you're saying. And he went out on the porch and a rooster crowed. Now, it's easy to condemn Peter for cowardly, the way he denied Jesus here, which is well known. But should not forget the courage that he had shown earlier. Because when they came to arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, it was Peter that took his sword and was ready to defend Jesus and cut off the ear of the high priest. And that's when Jesus said, Peter, put your sword back. Shall I not drink the cup that my Father has given me? But now, Peter had come and not only following Jesus, but he went inside the courtyard. It took a lot of courage to get up close enough that he could follow and find out what was happening to Jesus. But he was trying to do it anonymously. And when this girl identified him in front of the other guards, in front of the others, he lost his courage. He said, I don't understand what you're talking about. I don't know this man. And the rooster crowed. And then it says that after he went out, the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, this is one of them. But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, surely you're one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it. Then he began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." And a second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And when he thought about it, he wept. In Luke's account, it tells us that at that moment, Jesus turned and looked, and they made eye contact, and Peter wept. Here was this man, this strong Galilean fisherman, weeping, knowing what he had just betrayed and denied his Lord. But this was the last time that ever happened in Peter's life. The same Lord that he denied took him back. And the reason that all four of the gospel account, this account of Peter denying Jesus, is found in all four of the gospel accounts. How do we account for that? It's very important. And how did it get there? The answer, I believe, is Peter talked about it everywhere he went. The reason his other disciples knew about this account so well is because they heard it from the lips of Peter time and time again. Whenever Peter would talk about Jesus, he would say, "Have you ever denied him? I know you have, because I denied him myself." And he would tell the story. And he was ashamed of it, and he told it about himself and his own weakness to help others. And that was the last time Peter ever denied him. Because history records that he was crucified upside down in his testimony of his faith of Jesus. So as we look at this, what happened here in the early hours of the morning, we learn something from these participants. 71 men of the council, what do they teach us? They teach us that we can allow fear to take hold of our hearts, and it can lead to terrible things. Jesus' own testimony teaches us who he is. He's more than just a great teacher. He's more than a prophet. He is the I Am, the priest king, who sits on the right hand of God in heaven and is going to come again in the clouds of heaven with all power and authority. And Peter's denial is a reminder that all of us who have answered the call to be the followers of Jesus, that we're tempted at times to deny that we even know him. We don't even know that man. And it is an invitation for us to have the courage to not ever allow that to happen again. To be kept, to have the speak up, to be counted among his followers, to not be ashamed of him in our testimony of our faith. And so today, if you're here and subject to the invitation of Jesus, that those events that happened there that day changed history, they changed our lives, they brought into effect the fullness of God's eternal plan for our redemption, we have the opportunity to respond to that today through the gospel, to believe and repent of our sins and confess and be baptized into Christ, and not only to stop there, but to live for him. To have the courage of our conviction, to be counted as one of his followers, to speak up, "Yes, I know the man, and I believe with all of my heart that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God." Let's stand together and sing the invitation song as we stand and sing.